and welcome to another episode of Sniffing the Pages. I'm Nina Manning.
I'm Katie Griffiths.
And in this episode, we'll be discussing The Gift of Friends by Emma Hannigan, a life-affirming, uplifting novel celebrating the strengths and joys of female friendships, the final novel by the much-loved writer of women's fiction. We will also be discussing the new novel by Louisa Traeger, The Dragon Lady, a daring blend of romance, crime and history, and an intelligent expose of the inherent injustice and consequences of all forms of oppression. I'll be revealing my thoughts on the brand new psychological thriller by Lucy Clark, You Let Me In, and Katie will be telling us what other books she's been devouring in What Katie Read Next. And finally, we'll be revealing two more great fiction reads. So, first on to The Gift of Friends by Emma Hannigan. And this is Emma's final book because in 2018, in February, Emma sadly passed away from breast cancer. But just before she did, she managed to finish the first proof.
Yeah, she delivered the first draft of the new novel to her editors in January 2018. It says, and she sent over acknowledgements for this book just days before she passed away. So yeah. That's what this book is. So it's worth mentioning it because it says it in the proof copy and it says it in all the information about it. So I think it was hard to read it without having that in the back of my mind.
Mm.
And it probably did affect a little bit how I read the book.
Yeah.
Not necessarily in a bad way, just in that I was, if anything, it just made the whole thing feel more poignant.
Mm.
Almost didn't want it to end because it's like these are the characters that she was writing, that she sort of escaped into to write when she was going through cancer treatment.
That would be living on after her.
Yeah, it's a real. I mean, it's funny actually. I think we spoke about it a little bit, didn't we? That you've read books by authors who have passed away before, and it's never really been. Obviously, you don't really necessarily think of it, but I think because it's so immediate that she was writing this while she was going through the treatment for her cancer, so. And then, you know, she did pass away just after finishing the first draft and she had to pass it on to her editors to edit it without her input. It does feel a bit more immediate.
Yeah.
And it's just sad.
And I think there's the...
And she writes lovely books, so it's a real loss.
Oh, well, I'm definitely going to be reading more of hers, I think. I think the publishers were saying that they've obviously published sort of 9 or 10 books of hers by now, so
yeah. They
probably understand her style and...
Yeah, so it made it easier to do someone that they've worked with, and they've got, you know, she's got a back catalogue, so they understand exactly her writing style and how she communicates it, but, you know, it's still sad that she didn't get to finish it herself. I mean, it's a lovely book, so maybe should I read the blurb?
Yes, do read the blurb.
So you know what we're talking about.
Because there's lots of characters.
Yeah, there are lots of characters to keep hold of.
And it's got a little map at the beginning as well, which I like.
I love a book with a small map. So Kingfisher Road, a leafy, peaceful street in the town of Vayhill. But there are whispers behind closed doors. Who is moving into number 10? Engaged to handsome, wealthy Justin Johnston, Danielle appears to her neighbours to have the perfect glossy life, but not everything is as it seems. In fact, each of the four women who live close by has a secret, and each is nursing their own private heartache. But could a gift be waiting on their doorsteps? And by opening their front doors and their hearts to each other, could the women of Kingfisher Road discover all the help they need? So yeah, I think as you said at the beginning, is this about?
Does it just mention Danielle?
Yes, it just mentions Danielle. It doesn't explain.
Maybe they'll talk about other characters in the full.
So the other
characters.
So
we've got Maya.
Yeah.
Maya and Freddie.
Yeah, and their children Zach and Zara.
Mhm.
And then Nancy, who is on her. She's a bit older.
Yeah, she's 70.
No kids.
She hasn't got any kids.
Yeah.
And then we've got Betsy and Noel.
I love Betsy and Noel.
And they had Graham, their only son. And then they have Tasha and
his wife
Arnie.
Arnie, their son, yeah.
Later on. And there's Pearl and Seth and Drew.
Yes, and then little boy Drew.
And then there's Danielle and Justin.
Yes. So yeah, so there's five really, aren't there?
Yeah.
Is that five?
Yes.
Five lost count.
One. Two, three, four, five. Yeah.
Yeah, so five main female characters, and this is sort of their, each of them has a story and you sort of playing on this journey that they're all friends with each other and they're all really good friends, and it's, I guess, the main theme of the book is probably female friendship. And
Danielle comes into it a bit late, doesn't she? So the Maya and Nancy and Betsy and Pearl are a formed more of a firmer
a sort of solid friendship group. And so she moves onto this road, and Danielle is sort of at first a bit overwhelmed by all these women kind of wanting to know about her life and sort of wanting to be involved in her life. And she's a bit like, oh, what's going on? She's a lot younger as well, isn't she? She's only 20.
She's only 20.
Yeah, so she's really young. And but then, they all become good friends, and they're all.
And that's what's really lovely about it is the different age groups and how friendships can be formed between different generations. Because I have
friends,
I don't know about you, but I've got friends, particularly in my book club, and so I'm in my very early 40s. we've got my friend in her 50s, and then another one who's in her 60s. So three different generations
But absolutely. I've got people who I think consider good friends who are, you know, 20 years older than me, and I don't have any friends that are 20 years younger than me, sadly.
I've always hung out with people that were older than me as a younger, in my sort of late teens, early 20s. Yeah. I always tended to hang out with people who are about 10 years older than me.
Yeah, it's very mature.
Yeah.
It's nice to have depictions of female friendship where they're not all, like, they've been best friends. It's nice to have, obviously, friendships which are like they've been best friends since childhood and they're the same age and they're really good friends. But it's quite nice to have that representation of it being a bit more diverse in terms of age.
Mm.
And, like, therefore people bring in, you know, everyone's from different backgrounds and they're all bringing something different to the group, if that makes sense. So it's not necessarily as straightforward. And that's what real life is like, isn't it? Like,
yeah, definitely. Which was your favourite character? Or
I think Nancy.
Was it?
Nancy or... I actually really liked Danielle as well.
Did you? Oh, that's interesting.
I found...
Will you judge me if I say my favourite character was Maya? Or
no.
Maya. Would we say Maya or Maya? It's difficult to say. Isn't it M-A-I-A?
I think I would say Maya, but that doesn't
I'm saying
right.
Maya in my head, but... I liked the sort of
trashy
poshness about her.
To be honest with you, I liked them all. It's not to say that I didn't like any of them. I liked them all in different ways.
I think she was the one that bounced off the page the most for me.
I liked because the sort of her... unapologeticness of her.
Yeah.
So she was just very much, she's who she is, so she's not come from a background of money, and she's very much just being herself. Like, she's dressing how she wants to dress and... existing how she wants to exist, I guess. And I like their relationship as well. And I guess
Maya
also she...
Freddie.
Yeah, she resonated a bit with me maybe as well because she was the one who was most clearly a mother in the book. So her twins are sort of growing up and moving away and she's like struggling with her sense of identity and self because they're going to leave home.
I still felt she was so young, actually, wasn't she? She wasn't...
Yeah, it was interesting. I suppose she must have been quite young when she had them. I can't really remember.
She must have been quite young when she had them because I felt like she was only in her 40s. So they're sort of...
They were
late teens, weren't they?
Yeah, they were going off to university, weren't they? But that kind of... I mean, obviously my children are much, much younger than that, but that sense of, you know, you immerse yourself in motherhood and then there comes a point where you're needed less and less and you have to suddenly realise that what have you got left of yourself?
Imagine with twins for many, many years, you have to be completely
involved. That must be extremely involving.
Two kids both the same age. Different sexes, so both wanting to go off and do different things. Yeah, I can't imagine actually what it must be like to have multiple children.
Yeah. I liked them all. The only characters I didn't like were probably ones I was supposed to not like, so that's cool.
And there was a couple of baddies.
Yeah, so Justin's mum is not a friendly character.
Yeah.
So I think it's like quite clear again earlier on, so Danielle and Justin have got together. He's really, really, really rich.
He's old money.
And she's not... but they've fallen in love and they've moved in together and they've got engaged and his mum really doesn't like her as being really snobby and basically just a total bitch about
it. Downright rude.
I mean, really bad.
She really holds back, doesn't she, Danielle, right until the end, and then she lets rip, which is fantastic.
Yeah, and that was really nice because it felt like a really earned moment where she, you know, she finally gets to sort of stand up for herself. And
it was a proper American slow clap moment, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It was brilliant. I liked it. I mean, they all get their sort of, you know...
Sorry about the dog, by the way. That's
dog snoring in the background.
It's
that's
not
what
us.
That noise is.
She likes to join us on these podcasts, so can't really kick her out. Well, I could do, but we won't.
It's fine.
It's a nice, soothing background noise. Yeah, there was... What else was there? Lots of things. There was Betsy and Noel. So there were quite a lot of themes going on, wasn't there? Quite a lot of serious subjects that were sort of
I think, if anything, tackled, my actually. Issue was probably that there were too many. So everyone had an issue, and all of them were quite big issues. So it covers, like, adoption, domestic abuse. Well, not just adoption, actually. Adoption and...
The Magdalene laundry.
Yeah, so this is in Ireland, and it's...
Laundrette.
You know, someone who was forced to give up a... Laundry, yeah. someone who was forced to give up a baby when she was 16, you know, not with any choice, but because that was what happened at the time. And these are all quite big, sort of deep issues. And then there's this sort of, yeah, class snobbery that Danielle's dealing with. And I guess
Freddie's got business money issues, worries.
And Maya's got her children growing up and moving away. And it's just there was a lot. And I think...
Do you think maybe because Emma was writing at a time when there were so many things going on in her head that maybe she'd wanted just to cram as many stories in as she could.
Yeah, all of them were good stories, and I liked them, and I liked the way that they were told and that they resolved, but I think maybe some of them were just a bit... I could have done without some of them. But then equally without them, some of the characters would have been less interesting, so it's a really difficult balance.
I think so, yeah. I mean, there's only so much you can kind of say about...
There were just a couple of characters. Some really nice houses. You know, like Graham, for example, Betsy and Noel's son, who felt a little bit underdeveloped for me.
Yeah.
And he started off being this real, not a good character. Like,
he was a bit of a knob, wasn't he?
Yeah, a bit of a dick. And then just really suddenly sort of seems to change his attitude quite a lot without much...
reasoning.
Yeah, without much justification. And so I think maybe just little things like that, little characters like that, where a little bit more explanation or a sort of... exploration, I guess, of their motives or what's happening with them would have maybe helped a little bit in terms of realizing them. But then they are peripheral characters, and the main characters all felt really well realized.
Yeah Some of them were really shocking, actually. Tasha, she just, every time she walked into a room and opened her mouth, I was like, can't believe she just said that.
Yeah, absolutely outrageous. And
so what I couldn't work out was that, maybe because we're reading the proof, but the baby son, originally there was a scene with Betsy questioning how the baby was sitting up. So I was wondering if at some point they were going to say, oh, actually he was older than...
Well, he was meant to be older about 4 months.
They said he was 4 months, but when he arrived, she said, oh, he's actually quite a lot bigger than she thought. So I thought so maybe...
he was actually going to be older, yeah. I suppose four months isn't entirely impossible to be sitting. Like, I can't remember what my children sat up now.
I think that she's propped him up, but But yeah, it was a heartwarming cast, wasn't it? Very colourful.
Yeah, I really like it. It's a lovely book. I mean, if you know, that's sort of women's fiction, and it's, you know, it explores and deals with some quite serious issues.
Yeah, it did, actually. It kind of shocked me once it got into the sort of nitty-gritty of the relationship between Pearl and Seth, which
that's what I love about this sort of book, is that they do
quite
really...
difficult. At times, actually, to read that, wasn't it? It was quite intense.
Yeah, bits of it were quite hard to read, and were actually quite sort of, not brutal necessarily, but, you know, unpleasant. It did deal with unpleasant issues, and the stuff about Nancy and the adoption early in her life, again, is really shocking. So I think it's, you know, it's one of those books where you look from the front and it does look all sort of frothy and light, and I don't know what the actual cover's going to look like, because this is a proof copy, but... Actually, within it, as well as being heartwarming and lovely, and it is all of those things, it does actually tackle some quite serious issues,
and it tackles them
quite well, with well realised characters who, you know, react in ways that are believable.
Yeah, it was quite surprising. I always start off reading books like this thinking, oh, I know these characters inside out, I know where this is going to go, I read this style of writing so many times, and then halfway through I'm literally hooked. I'm like, I don't want to say goodbye to them, I love them all.
Absolutely, and that's exactly it. Those characters that are drawn with, like, or written, I suppose, drawn with, I guess, with love, so that they come alive and you do feel like you're friends with them. And I, you know, I just wanted to go to their houses and, like, join in their tapas and wine.
Yeah, I know,
that
me
sounded
too.
Really fun.
I
want to live on Kingfisher Road.
I know, I just thought, how fantastic. Wouldn't it be great if the village that we lived in was so much in closer proximity to one another, because we're so spread out. I just think there'd be a lot more of popping in and out of each other's houses. I know when I had
a real community,
friend who lived over the road, and she's moved away now, but we used to pop in each other's houses all the time, and just loved that sort of community vibe.
Yeah, it's really nice. And I think, yeah, it's just that
Nice houses though, weren't they?
They did sound like lovely houses. And I liked that they weren't all... that people who were living in those houses didn't necessarily all come from the most straightforward backgrounds, if that makes sense. They didn't all get there, arrive there in the same or most logical way.
Mm.
So sort of one of them was, you know, some obviously Justin's old money, but some of them are newer money and some of them have...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love the way that Maya and Freddie had to hire a woman to come and teach them how to... eat and entertain and do all things like that.
Yeah, pretend to be posh, basically. Yeah. But I love that because it's so real, like that sort of stuff.
And then he's got a bit of a shady past, and then I like the way it all sort of reveals what's been going on behind closed doors that Maya didn't understand. And then she sort of steps in as that sort of mafia kind of wife, doesn't she? She's like, don't worry, I've got your back.
What I liked about that though is that she's obviously, you know, she's feeling a bit disempowered, like her children are growing up in a way, and she's like, oh, what am I if I'm not a mum, and all I've achieved in the last 18 years is raising my children, which is a massive thing to achieve, to be honest. But she's feeling a bit sort of like she's not necessarily recognising her own worth or her own skills and abilities. And what I liked about that at the end is that she does actually come through and she's the one that sorts it out. And it's like, actually, she's an incredibly capable, competent woman, and she's been raising two children and running a household all this time. And that's not a straightforward or, you know, small thing to be doing. So actually, she's that kind of realisation for her that she's more than she was thinking she is.
Yeah.
It was very satisfying to read.
Going to talk about The Dragon Lady by Louisa Traeger.
Hang on,
should I read the blurb? Is there enough light in here? So it's
very, no, I can just about read it.
It's very romantic mood in here this evening. We've got candles.
Candlelit. If I stumble, it's because I can't read the words. Opening with the shooting of Lady Virginia Corto in 1950s Rhodesia, The Dragon Lady tells the story of this spirited, boundary-breaking woman with a snake tattoo running the length of one leg. From the glamorous Italian Riviera before the Great War, via the Art Deco glory of Eltham Palace, where Jeannie is ostracised for being a foreign divorcee at the time of Edward the Eighth. That's my really bad reading of Roman numerals there. I was like, 5, 6, 7, 8, Edward the Eighth.
And I was going, okay.
And Mrs. Simpson. The Courtauld's leave the confines of post-war Britain to forge a new life in Rhodesia, only to find that being progressive liberals during segregation proves mortally dangerous.
She's had a few pina coladas, everyone.
I'm blaming the white on red writing in the candlelight. That's my story, I'm sticking to it. Deeply evocative of time and place, The Dragon Lady subtly blends fact and fiction to paint the portrait of an extraordinary woman in an era of great social and cultural change. Okay, got three. See, I mean, this is fascinating. As I was when I started reading it, I hadn't really read the blurb, I just jumped in. And I had to stop myself and be like, wait, is this... historical fiction in that is, was she a real character? Because she's almost so like avant-garde for the time, it's almost not believable. And so I was a bit like, this can't be right. And then once I found out she was real, I liked it a lot more.
So did you Google her straight away or did...
Yeah, pretty early on. Just because I genuinely wanted to know.
I didn't need to because you told me that already.
Yeah, that's true.
But then I did go on to Google August Courtland.
Courtauld. So I think I Googled her to check she was real. And then I read the book because I didn't want to know too much about her life before I read the book. I thought it might be more engaging or enjoyable without that knowledge. But I did look her up again at the end. Just to have an idea of how much was real in her. Because that's always interesting with historical fiction. Like how much is fact and how much is fiction.
It's an interesting blend of fact and fiction, wasn't it?
Yeah, so I think with most historical fiction, I think... And I think it says in this sort of author's note at the end... Like, broadly speaking, it's factually correct in terms of things that happened and dates that they happened and sort of events, as it were. But all of the stuff in between, all of the character motives, all of that stuff, that's obviously all fictionalised. She's a fascinating character.
Yeah.
I thought it was too short. I would have liked more of... I think maybe that's my... I mean, I really enjoyed it, to be clear, but my major criticism of maybe is that it could have been more of it. A bit more in depth.
Yeah, it was quite a short book, wasn't it? And it tended to jump between eras and narratives, didn't it? So we weren't...
Yeah, so it's seeing them at different points in their life. So they're sort of, they're in Rhodesia, which is nowadays is Zimbabwe. And
then they're
sort of in England post-war, but they're also...
Post-First World War.
And then they're in Rhodesia post-Second World War. But then there are also bits of them individually before they got together. Mm. So this is her and her husband, Stephen, to be clear. And then there's also sort of a narrative from a young girl who lives in Rhodesia at the same time as them.
Mm. But we don't know who that is until the end.
It's not entirely clear who that is at the beginning. But I found that quite helpful, actually, because it gave it a lot more... It made the place sense of place feel a bit more real. And I think that's one of the things it does really well, is it does have a good...
Such a short book, there was a lot of jumping between locations and
frames. It maybe felt like it made the narrative a little bit... And also a bit difficult to follow. So it starts with an event that it then goes back and leads up to, if that makes sense. So I think you said it on the blurby bit, it starts with her being shot... And then it sort of jumps back and explains all the events leading up to her being shot. But as well as that, it jumps further back to give, I guess, more background or depth to their characters and their lives.
Yeah, it's quite an interesting crime thriller from that perspective as well, isn't it?
Yeah, so it took a long time for me to work out who had done it. I should have thought of that person earlier.
I found the parts where the King Edward the VIII and his... mistress at the time, wasn't she, Wallis Simpson, when they came to dinner at the palace.
Yeah,
that was fascinating because obviously they're real people and that was a real situation, and then he very shortly after that stepped down, didn't he, when he renounced the throne.
He wanted to marry a divorced woman, so he had to
twice divorce woman, wasn't she? Was she twice divorced?
I do not know.
Yeah,
my modern history is appalling. Yeah, so it's interesting. It's always interesting when they intersect with very, very well-known historical figures, that, you know, people like this. Their interaction with them was really interesting. And because Jeannie in the book is a divorcee as well, she had felt sort of kinship with Wallis Simpson, a sort of sense of, like, she obviously quite liked her and found her very relatable. So there's that kind of element of it as well. But they also, later on, her husband has a meeting with Robert Mugabe, right at the very beginning of his sort of political career. And they don't really go into that, where that's going to go. But again, just was really interesting, just that sort of insight into, insight into the background of people that, you know, you hear about with a lot of notoriety.
Yeah, and they were very different to everybody else who was around them at that time, specifically in the 50s when they were in Zimbabwe.
Yes,
and how they were trying to go against the grain and trying to cause a little bit of change, and all it did was cause hatred.
A lot of resentment, yeah. I mean, it's really interesting, because again, that's why I said, like, when I first started reading, I think it's why I immediately Googled her, is that genuinely, if I had read these characters and they were purely fictional, I probably wouldn't have found them believable. Like, the fact that they really were that progressive and that liberal at that time, living in Africa and having those opinions is obviously extremely rare at the time. But it's also a bit of a wake-up call, isn't it? Because it does make you realise that's not that long ago.
No.
Those opinions, which are basically that, you know, people who are native to Africa are less than the white settlers, was really prevalent. I mean, it was so prevalent that to express a different opinion was to not just social suicide, but actually caused genuine danger to their lives.
It was a fascinating illustration of how fear of change can breed anger and violence so quickly.
And I guess it made me really think, like, that's not that long ago, and that there are people still now who hold those opinions, and it made it feel quite immediate.
It can happen on such a small scale, can't it? I mean, if you're at a dinner party or just having a conversation with friends and you throw something into the conversation that people have never considered before.
Yeah.
For their whole life they've been told one thing, and then all of a sudden you say, well, actually.
Yeah, and they've just believed it without ever really thinking about it or questioning it.
Some people can get very angry. I've been in situations like that before. Yeah. And it's like, you know.
And that's what this felt. It's like, you know, obviously they didn't want to have that, the sort of, the comfort and the safety of white supremacy to be questioned or changed in any sense. Because obviously that would completely topple their worldview and their lives and to question that for them was absolutely just, yeah, not tolerable at all. But it was, yeah, I say it's just genuinely interesting to find such progressive views in people who really were alive at that time and these things that they really did do.
So I think fascinating from a historical perspective, but there was just something that was not allowing me to connect with the book on an emotional level, and I don't know perhaps exactly what it was, but there was just something that didn't quite do it for me and I can't quite put my finger on it.
I think I found her as a character quite polarising, in that at times I really admired her and I thought she was really interesting. And to be fair, that's not true. I do really admire her and she was really interesting. But I also found her a bit frustrating in some senses. And I suppose that's probably partly just a product of her time.
Mm.
And, you know, I think because she was a very progressive liberal person of her time, my expectations of her are like kind of concurrent with someone who is a bit more modern. But actually she still did live in that time. She still existed in that world. So maybe that's why she felt a little bit frustrating at times.
Because
all the characters were really real, engaging, really believable. I think maybe just the jumping around in time made it hard to really pull into the flow of it.
Yeah, I think so. I think that was it.
And yeah, I say, for me, it could have been longer and just a bit more in depth in certain elements, I suppose.
Mm.
And there's this thing about her, you know, she has this snake tattoo all up her leg, which is an incredibly shocking thing to have for a woman at that time. Like, just almost unheard of, really, for someone to have done that.
Mm.
And so there's sort of hints all the way through at this kind of different stories she tells to different people to justify or to explain it. Mm. She sort of like makes up different stories to tell different people. And I really wanted to know the actual real life answer.
Mm.
And I tried Googling it a little bit. I never found an answer as if anyone actually really knows why she had it.
What do you think would have changed about her as a character or the relationship between her and Stephen if they had been parents? Do you think maybe because they had that extra amount of time and they didn't?
Yeah, maybe it's having something else to focus on, something external, and that's partly what she gave a lot of their energy to, that maybe made them able to feel. But I think maybe partly for her it's because she was, you know, ostracised from polite society in Britain. And, you know, she didn't do what her family expected or wanted her to do. As a schoolgirl, she got this tattoo, which was really shocking. So she obviously was quite, from a very young age, was this quite avant-garde character. I guess to a certain extent, she probably got to the point where it wasn't about what people thought anymore. Or she was used to being different or considered different. And maybe it made her more able to have those views and to have her focus be external in that way and do these sort of amazing things that they did for the country or in the country.
This week I've been thrilled by the spine-chilling new novel by Lucy Clark, You Let Me In. Lucy's fifth novel follows the life of Elle Fielding, a writer estranged from her husband, struggling to complete her second anticipated novel. We meet Elle when she's returned from a two-week break in France, having rented her own swanky Cornish seaside pad out on Airbnb. As Elle tries to get back into the swing of life and focus on meeting her excruciatingly close deadline, she begins to notice a few strange things about the house. A chipped glass paperweight, the unlocked writing room she left locked before she left, and the sensation that she's being monitored. The novel jumps between timelines, a younger Elle in her university days and the current Elle. There is also an unidentified narrator, and this is the person who's been renting Elle's house while she's been away. Now, everyone around Elle is a potential suspect, and we're thrust into a world of paranoia as Elle's concept of what is reality and what is her overactive imagination is tested as she deals with the mysterious happenings. With a nod to Stephen King's Misery, Elle encounters her very own number one fan as she exposes edited snippets of her life on social media sites for the approval of her readers. I love the familiarity of this book and how well Lucy portrayed the life of a writer with real honesty. I love the relatability factor and how current the book feels, with references to Airbnb, hashtags and oversharing online. This book feels searingly real from the outset to the final crescendo with a double twist ending. Creepy, edgy and a totally satisfying read. I highly recommend you rush out and get your copy of You Let Me In by Lucy Clark, out in paperback now. So we're talking about the difference between physical and e-books, because I always just love the smell of the books, hence why we called the podcast Sniffing the Pages. And I've recently been reading a couple of books on the e-book and just not being able to connect with them at all.
Yeah, and I think, I suppose for me, because I read, well, not always, but a lot of the time it's sort of a kind of an escape or a, I feel like I'm going into another world when I read a book. Mm. And that feels somehow more with a physical book. I'm not, obviously not physically leaping into it, but it does feel more, I feel more involved or more engaged. I don't know. And I know
that, it's just the tangible experience, isn't it? That's just...
Yeah, and yet there are so many good things about having an e-reader, which means people can read much more accessibly. Obviously, the book storage issue, which we both have excessive issues with, is not there. And, you know, to be honest with you, I'm never going to have a problem with anything that gets more people reading. But for me personally, I don't find that that's another way I would prefer to read. I just find, I don't think I engage in quite the same
way. Doesn't feel the same at all. And I've just discovered that more recently. And I keep thinking, well, I'll go back to them. I've got this great Amazon Kindle Fire starter thing. No, it's not Fire Starter. Whatever it's called, I don't know. My husband bought for me last year. And it's great because it's, you know, you can get all these lovely books and you see the front covers and you're like, oh, that's great. I really want to read that one. It's a click away and it can be mine. So there's that element. And then and then it's gone. The high is left the building.
I just shouldn't be trusted with the ability to buy books that quickly and easily. But I just really shouldn't. I would have no money left. If I had an e-reader, it would be terrifying. I have... a bad enough addiction to buying books as it is, let alone being able to go, oh, look, that one's 99p on Kindle today, buy that one, and I'd have about 25,000 books in my to-be-read pile, and it's already quite excessive as it is.
So I know.
I just think I would be overwhelmed by the sheer number of books that exist.
I feel I'm overwhelmed at the moment because I have to-be-read piles everywhere, physical ones, and now I'm stacking up some...
I know, they're everywhere, aren't they? It's constant.
Non-physical ones as well, so...
And yeah, this is the thing, so I think, you know... Normally, I obviously have extra books that I read, apart from the books that we're discussing for the podcast. But this time, I feel like this was like a confession. I've been rereading books that I've read before. I do it quite a lot. And it's a really contentious bit. People are really surprised when I say it. Mm. But I do it really frequently. And it's probably partly because I do read really quickly. So I guess I got used to rereading books when I was a bit younger, when there weren't always so many books available. And it was just, I couldn't keep up with my own reading habit.
But also, are you morphing this into what Katie read next?
I am. Yeah, because the answer to what Katie read next is not very much. So it's not going to be a very long section in and of itself. So I've been rereading a fantasy series that I read. The series is called Throne of Glass series, and it's by Sarah J. Maas. And they're great. And rereading, when I reread, it's often fantasy.
How many are in the series?
Seven.
Oh, I was going to say.
I haven't reread all seven, though.
Because you were quite depressed when it ended, weren't
you?
Yeah,
I know. And this is the thing. So when series like that end, I find it really sad because I feel like I've lost that part of my life. Obviously, I'm over-engaging with these books. And so I just want to go back to it.
Mm.
And at times when I'm really busy or really stressed, I just find that easier than reading something new. I think one of the questions I get asked quite a lot, like when I'm talking to people about the podcast, is how do you find enough time to read?
Mm.
And for me, it's not necessarily physical time, partly because I read quite quickly anyway, and I read in the evenings, and I barely watch any TV. So that's the space that I have for it. But also, there are times when it's just hard work to read new things. Like I feel it's harder than just falling back into a world which I've been in before, and all the characters feel really familiar. And it feels really safe and enjoyable at times when you're really busy and stressed and life's just a bit much.
I don't reread. I haven't reread anything really at all. But I can understand probably from a film perspective, because there might be times when something pops up and it's on the TV and everyone else is watching at the same time as you, and you think, oh, I've seen it 25 times, but I really want to watch it because it's so comforting.
I think that's what it's like. And I guess it's just because I'm a bit unusual in that I probably read a lot more than I watch TV or watch films. And those are the things that I go back to. So I don't necessarily watch programmes over and over or watch films over and over, but I do read books over and over. I have been known to finish a book and go back and start it again immediately.
Really?
It absolutely appalls my husband. He's like, are you still reading that? I'm like, oh no, I finished it, but I've just started again because I couldn't bear for it to be over. He's like, it's so weird.
You're like the child that never grew up, because that's such a kid thing to do.
Well, I did it when I was a child and I still do it now sometimes.
You're like the Peter Pan of the book world.
I've never lost my childish wonder at the world of books. But it's true, actually, I genuinely haven't, and maybe that's why I really like the sort of kind of young adult fantasy stuff where it's really
so do you think it will get easier to say goodbye to the characters by book 7 once you've finished reread this series again?
I don't know that I will reread the whole series just yet. I was just having a really busy couple of weeks, and I just thought about, I looked at all my books on my to be read pile and just thought, I don't have the energy for any of them. So the thing about rereading for me as well is it just takes very little energy, because you already know the story and you already know the characters, so you're just dropping back into a really familiar pattern, and you can read, it's much more relaxing as an activity for me than rereading, than reading new books. But no, I think if I get myself all the way to the end of the 7, I'll probably be really sad again. But I probably won't read them again just yet. Probably one day, though. I would be very surprised if I didn't read them again at some point in my life.
So you said to me earlier, but before we started recording, that you're reading these because you're feeling quite tired from generally reading at the moment. So I think that's kind of where I'm at the moment as well. So maybe I need to reread something, or just not read and just watch TV.
Yeah, I suppose it depends whatever shuts your... It's about having time to switch off, I think. So, and maybe particularly because we've been reading in a really active way. So often, you know, we're reading books to discuss them, and that means you're paying a lot of attention. You're reading them, bearing in mind, you know, thinking about how you're reacting to it.
And you have to finish it.
An analytical approach to it in your head.
It feels like a homework assignment, doesn't it? Have to finish it. Even though you get to a point where you think, oh, I might not be enjoying this, and if this wasn't a book for the podcast, you might have just put it to one side and picked it up.
Yeah, there've
time.
Only been, I think, a couple.
Yeah, luckily. Well, we've only had a couple like that.
There's only two I can think of that I felt like that about. But generally, I just, it's maybe just feel a bit more engaged in it, and I guess for me, rereading is more like watching mindless crap on TV. Not that the books are crap themselves, it's just that the amount of effort I have to put into it, having already read it before, is much lower, and so I can just kind of zone out and drop into it. I don't know how I can explain it really well, but it does feel like just going back to characters I really like, and going back with old friends, and that thing where you can just completely relax, and it doesn't feel like an effort anymore.
Just trying to think what book I would really like to reread.
I'm always really interested in this question with people, because very few people I've met have responded to me saying that I reread a lot.
I mean, I keep my books, obviously, because I think I'm going to reread them at some point.
Yeah, so that's the good thing, is it does really justify my large book collection, because I can genuinely say, well, I'll probably reread them. And that's almost always true. And so when we had to move house, for example, we had to get rid of a lot of books, obviously. I know, it's very painful. And I was just like, well, I can justify keeping lots and lots of things, because I can say I'll probably read them again. And it made life a lot easier for me. My husband had to get rid of loads more than me, because he doesn't reread, so. He had no justification.
Shocking.
I won that battle.
No, I've just, listeners, I have a problem. I have far too many books that haven't been read. My daughter walks around the house all the time picking books up, going, Mummy, have you read this one yet? Have you read that one yet?
Nope, it's in a pile.
Yeah, I can't remember. But yeah, it's got a little bit out of hand. So I was in Waterstones yesterday, and the woman was so desperate to sell me a book. It was the book of the, you know, they have their little pile of the book of the week.
Yeah.
And I was like, it looks really fascinating. I'm so tempted. I was like, I literally can't do it. I'm sorry.
I can't. I need to clear some of my pile. Yeah. Please let me leave.
I said, I just came in to soak up the atmosphere. And
this is the problem, is I just like being in bookshops.
Yeah.
But then when I'm in a bookshop, I want to buy books. I suppose you just need to go to the library, don't we, really?
Yeah.
Be amongst the books.
Yeah, but that's another problem as well, because I go to the library and then I check out like 5 books and I bring them home. I go, well, I haven't got time to read these.
Yeah, absolutely.
So they're going back tomorrow.
Also, I don't like to let them go again.
Yeah.
So it's like, oh, no.
Though you can rent them at any time.
I could go and get them back again. I know that's how the library works. And, you know, to be fair, I do use the library. Particularly good for sort of trying new authors or trying new things. I have, on the past, though, bought and read a library book, given it back, and then had to go and buy it.
Oh.
So that I could reread it. But honestly, I have a problem as well. A slightly different problem. Well, we both got problems.
I went to the library recently and took out a book, and the librarian said to me, you know, you took this book out in August 2017. And one of my mum friends was there, and she looked at me and went, you just had a baby then. And I was like, oh, yes, that was probably why I didn't read that.
That was optimistic.
And then I brought it home for the second time and then still didn't read it.
Oh.
So, yeah, I just like being in libraries and bringing books home and then taking them back again.
It's easier than going, it's cheaper than going to the bookshop.
I take them on a little holiday, bring them to my house.
My kids go to the library a lot and go and get lots of books out and bring them back, and obviously can... I do read all the books they get from the library, because they're all really short.
Yeah.
So that's fine.
Well, that's it. Because if you think about how many books we're actually reading, we're reading all our kids' books as well.
Yeah, I mean, that pushes my number up, because I have to read quite a lot of books a day.
Do you feel, actually, when you're sat there reading your books to your kids, I'm like, oh, I'm reading like 3 books a night to my middle child.
Yeah.
Because he can't read, well, he's a pretty good reader, but I still read all his books to him.
Yeah, well, it's that interesting stage, isn't it? My little girl's getting to the stage where she can read a book, but a very simple, like quite early sort of stages book, and they're not very interesting, those books that they can read, because it's really hard to write an engaging story when you have to apply phonics.
Sound
up. You've got to sound every word, so we still read to her because she can hear much more interesting and engaging stories that way.
Mm.
But yeah, if I could count all the children's books I read, my goodness, I'd be reading a lot.
Yeah,
although
that's
lots
what
of them would be. See, kids reread loads, and this is clearly the point, it's just I'm a giant child, but. My children reread the same book over and over and over and over again.
When, so on the evenings when I'm sat there with my son thinking, oh, it's 8 o'clock, I really want to be reading my book, but it's okay because I'm still reading.
Yes.
I'm just reading.
And I'm instilling a love for stories in the next generation.
Just reading Julia Donaldson instead of...
Although my son's favourite book at the moment is an Usborne book called Noisy Bottoms.
Oh.
And it's like a sound book, so it's just a lot of fart noises.
Oh, really?
Absolutely, yeah. He's just turned 3, and obviously he adores that.
Yes. He's still in the anal phase. If I could just use the psychological term for that. Everything's about bums, isn't it?
Yeah.
Up until that point.
No, both my 3 and my 4-year-old are in that phase. Trust me. Nothing is so funny as the word bum.
Here's something interesting I tried this week. Still talking about books.
I was going to say, that was interesting to see. I'm a bit worried now.
I listened to an audiobook for the first time
ever.
That's
astonishing.
And I didn't like it.
I know. So I do listen to audiobooks, but I listen to audiobooks to go to sleep too.
Right.
Again, I don't know if this is a normal thing that people do, but so I've recently learnt how this started, and the reason is because my son now needs it. So apparently when my brother was a little boy... similar age to my son now, he had similar problems, which is that they can't go to sleep. So my little boy really struggles to fall asleep, and one of the things that really helps him fall asleep is to be listening to a story, so that he's sort of not trying to sleep but listening to a story and then just falls asleep because he's tired. And so it's basically become habit that I obviously grew up with my brother having these audiobooks on, and that's what helped him go to sleep, and I've got so used to it that I really struggle to sleep without them now.
Really?
But I only listen to audiobooks at night that I have also read.
Do you have earphones to listen to them?
Yeah, so I just have one headphone, otherwise my husband would really hate me, wouldn't he?
Yeah.
So I just have one headphone in, yeah.
And yeah, I just downloaded the app from the library one, which I can't see on here. Oh, yes, I can. It's called BorrowBox. And I just thought it was the library app because I had one on my phone ages ago. And I thought, oh, that's come off for some reason because I've changed my phone. And then I saw that, downloaded it, and then borrowed a book that I really wanted to read, and then realised it was an audio book.
Oh, no.
And I was like, oh, I'll give it a whirl. And I didn't like it.
So the times I think audiobooks are helpful is if you, like, any times I've listened to them and they've been new stories, not, like, audiobooks I've been listening to sleep, which I've already read. Otherwise, I find I stay awake to hear what's going to happen next. So I can't listen to audiobooks where I don't know what's going to happen next. Otherwise,
so I suppose
I can't
it must be like reading, because you get to a point in the page, don't you, when you're just reading a paragraph with your eyes flickering.
Yeah,
and you
it's
actually
basically
no
like
idea
reading
what's
yourself
going
to sleep without having to actually do it. But the only time I've actually listened to audiobooks actively is when I was doing really long commute and was driving to work.
Yeah, that would probably be good.
And that was because you can't read when you're driving a car.
I was trying to cook and the extractor fan had to keep going on and off, so that probably didn't help.
Yeah, I think it depends on your lifestyle. Like, I know people that listen to them quite a lot, and I guess it just depends on how you fit it in. It's a way to read without having to physically sit down and read.
I think what I didn't like was the voice that the narrator did for one of the characters. So it was a book by Jessica Knoll, and it something's happened to the sister. So the sister, the other sister's being interviewed.
Okay, yeah.
About her other sister. And by a TV interview type thing, not a police interview. And the TV presenter just pops up and suddenly the narrator's voice just went all like droney and just really strange. I was like, I can't bear it.
Yeah, so I think it probably depends a little bit on
I do it with my kids. I do the silly voices when I read to my kids.
But there are better and worse audiobooks. It depends on who records them. And it's a really difficult, I think it's probably
Would they always do that in audiobooks? Change the voice for different characters?
Usually a little bit, but not necessarily massively. So like probably the most well-known ones are the audiobooks of the Harry Potter series, which are read by Stephen Fry.
Okay.
And they are wonderful. Like if you like audiobooks, children like audiobooks.
Cool voices though.
But they're not really, it's really hard to describe. So he does change his voice a little bit, but it's not like a very big change.
Right.
Yeah. So you can maybe hear.
So you know he's in a different character's voice.
To a certain extent.
Because that's the point. You have to know that another character's speaking,
but it's more about intonation and inflection. Yeah. I guess that's the only thing. But he's probably the best example of an audiobook because he just has such a lovely voice anyway. It's very soothing to listen to.
Yeah. I just found it really difficult to get my head around because obviously when I'm reading a book, I can see exactly what's going on. Your eyes automatically scan to the he said or she said, so you know who's talking. But when you're listening, you've got to wait until the narrator's got to the end of the sentence before, okay, who's speaking or what's going on.
I think it depends. People probably different. Like I find it harder to follow a story in an audiobook. I find it easier to follow a story when I'm reading it myself.
Some people probably prefer
audiobooks, and that's, you know, that's great. Again, I suppose it's like reading on an e-reader, isn't it? Like, you just do what suits you. It's great that, I mean, there's so many more available now.
Yeah.
You know, they're a huge thing now, aren't they, audiobooks? Much bigger than they used to be,
Yes, it's an interesting world that I will not be entering again. Next time on Sniffing the Pages, we will be discussing
A Nearly Normal Family by M.T. Edvardsen.
The Carer by... I can't do it! Deborah Muckahawk!
I'm so good saying that. We'll try again. Okay, A Nearly Normal Family by M.T. Edvardsen.
The Carer by Deborah Muckahawk.
Completely lost, Nina. I'm going to have to read them all. It's just unbelievable. Right. We will be reading A Nearly Normal Family by M.T. Edvardsen, The Carer by Deborah Mogarth, and Your Truth or Mine by Tricia... I can't do either shit. I was doing so well. I got almost to the end. I had one more word.
Trisha Sacklecker.
That's too much.
I'm really sorry, Trisha, but it's so embarrassing because I'm actually going to be in conversation with Trisha Sacklecker.
Okay, I'm going to try that one more time so I've got something to edit from that's not for crying. So we'll be reading A Nearly Normal Family by M.T. Edvardsen, The Carer by Deborah Mogarth, and Your Truth or Mine by Trisha Sacklecker. Which I think is how we pronounce herself.
Yes. And also, Trisha's very kindly has very kindly said she'll be in conversation, but probably not after that palaver.
She is mangling her name in
So, yeah, I'm actually really excited about all of those.
Yeah, I've been really looking forward to getting to be The Carer. I'm really excited about it.
So that is it for this episode. Join us next time for more pina coladas and discussion giggles.
Goodbye.
Bye.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.